When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Bonathan Carlin.
And I'm Jen Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Griffin Door, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands and dust off your broomsticks and join us as we unlock the secrets behind Philosopher's Stone, Chapter 12, The Mirror of Erised.
Oh, man. From the very beginning of this whole show, this is like the chapter that I was like, I was so excited for.
You're so excited for this one?
I was very excited for it. And I did really bad math the first time that I was trying to like figure out when chapter 12 would land based on like, we started on like October 1st. And I think originally I was like, oh my gosh, the Mirror of Erised chapter 12 is going to land like on the episode that would come out around Christmas.
Man.
And I failed to realize that we released the first three episodes on day one.
Yeah.
And was not accounting for that. And therefore we are only 9 weeks from the original start date.
Yeah.
And
not 12.
Yeah. So we're,
but even 3 weeks from now isn't Christmas.
It's close. Well,
it is close,
as of recording. Yeah.
Yeah.
But on release
that's
day,
true. It's you're right. You're right. Because that's what I'm thinking of. I'm like, it's not, you not only messed up some math, we're not even close.
Listen, man, yeah. I went to wizard school and they don't teach math.
They don't teach math.
Anyway.
They don't have seven sided coins either.
Jay, tell me how you feel about the Mirror of Erised as a chapter. What do we have inside of this chapter?
All right. So basically, as just a basic plot summary of it, it is Christmas at Hogwarts. And Harry and basically just the Weasley brothers are left at the Gryffindor common room, where together they eat about 100 turkeys for dinner.
I wrote the same thing down at the feast. I'm like, why is it
why
so
is
big?
They're
like,
so big.
This is way too much food.
Way too much food. And then Harry gets the Cloak of Invisibility, which he takes out into the castle on Christmas night and discovers the Mirror of Erised, where he sees his parents for the very first time. And then he brings Ron to see it. And then on the third night, Dumbledore reveals himself and is like, I've been watching you the whole time, Harry. Just like that.
That's how you interpret Dumbledore.
Just like that.
It would, Harry. It would change the way in which I interpret the character rather drastically. I feel like it's amazing how much the delivery, you know, it's like, Harry?
Yeah.
Versus like, back again, Harry.
I know, yeah. Instead of like, if he's just sort of like some kooky old wizard.
You love kooky Dumbledore, though.
I do love kooky Dumbledore. Yeah. It's all sourced from the Potter Puppet Pals back in the day, which was like, if you don't know what Potter Puppet Pals is, I have great news for you. If you're 12 episodes into this Harry Potter podcast and haven't heard of it, whew. It is a trip down memory lane. It is a hilarious series. But anyway, the Dumbledore in that, he just looks like a little hand puppet, but he just talks. He's sort of like a total goofball.
He is a total goofball.
He's very kooky. So I would recommend go and check that out. But whenever I do Dumbledore voice, I always think that's a really funny one. If you've ever seen, a Harry Potter musical, it feels like that's the Dumbledore they also kind of sourced for their Dumbledore in that play.
Interesting.
He's just sort of very goofy and like, yeah, I'm the smartest one, but I'm not really paying attention to anything.
Right. Well, and there's no doubt. I mean, he's a fun-loving, whimsical guy, so there's that to be said for him. But anyway, let's go ahead and comb through the chapter, because I did have lots of notes, but I also had some like swaths of time where I didn't have any notes, which kind of surprised me, because this was like the chapter that I really thought things were going to go whiz bang pow, which to be fair they do. And if you subscribe to Dumbledore's big plan, which I absolutely do, there's lots of evidence inside of this chapter.
This is one of those chapters that is absolutely like a huge, this is like the huge Dumbledore's big plan is officially like, this is where you can point many arrows to.
Yes.
To be like, no, Dumbledore is absolutely setting things up for Harry.
Yes. Yeah. It feels like there can be just literally no mistake. So
yeah.
Anyway, let's go ahead and kick things off as we dive into the very first paragraph. There's always like one of these fun little bits that I feel without knowing, I know you also highlighted, which
I absolutely did.
It is the Weasley twins were punished for bewitching several snowballs, so they followed Quirrell around, bouncing off the back of his turban.
Oh my gosh. It's just like on your first pass of the book, you'd be like, oh, Quirrell, he can't even defend himself from the students.
Right. Yeah. Fred and George. Yeah, oh, man.
That's hilarious. But then when you read it, it's like the Weasley twins were like having snowballs hit Voldemort in the face, which is just epic.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
They don't even know.
It's just like,
it doesn't say who punished them, but I never take it as Quirrell punished the Weasley twins.
Right.
You
right.
Know? He's just sort of letting it happen. Like, I imagine Voldemort's like, Quirrell. What are you doing?
He has to, he has to maintain like his sort of like pushoveredness.
Yeah.
The fainting at trolls kind of behavior.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, he's definitely, yeah. So it wasn't Quirrell. It wasn't Quirrell. Almost certainly Snape.
Yeah. I feel, almost McGonagall. Certainly Snape. Yeah. Yeah. Could absolutely be it. So yeah, I love that just little inclusion, little nod to hitting Voldemort in the face there. It talks about how cold the castle is, like a bitter wind rattled the windows. You know, the corridors had become icy is what it says. The drafty corridors had become icy. I'm always like, why is this the case? Like, shouldn't it like magically be warm in the castle?
That's a good point. I was about to point out the fact that I was like, Jay, it's a castle. You know, it's a stone structure.
It's a magic castle, Ben.
But it is in fact
shouldn't
a magic
have
castle.
These problems.
This is one of those things where I tend to imagine the corridors to absolutely be inside of the castle, and on some level they just simply are. I wouldn't believe any other explanation. But like inside of like Philosopher's Stone, we see lots of like courtyard related scenes where the corridor may literally bring you physically outside, similar to like the breezeway we had, in our middle school.
That's true.
You could walk outside to go to lunch. Yeah,
that's true. It could be the case like that. I also think,
especially
I think a lot of times at Hogwarts, there is like this unwritten rule that Dumbledore like doesn't like the fact that the corridors are like icy and windy and stuff. It's like, it feels like a very magically fixable problem. And I feel like there's a lot of things that Dumbledore is like, I like things to be like a little more muggly than they need to be for the sake of the students having to overcome stuff.
This is boot camp.
Because not only is there stuff like this, but then later in the chapter, we're going to meet Madam Pince,
the librarian who has no interest in helping.
Who has no interest in like helping the students find. But it's just like there's too many teachers at a school who like just seem like they actively hate children.
Yes.
You know, it's like, right. Why? Why would you have Filch working here? Why would you have a librarian who hates kids working at a school? Why would you have Snape who hates kids working at a school? I mean, Snape, you know the reason.
Snape's a completely different story. Yeah. But like, no, you're absolutely correct. I mean, even Hagrid, I think, like, sort of remarks like, wow, you guys are going to the library the day before break? He's kind of like, why?
Yeah.
So it's like, but if you're the librarian, you have to appreciate the kids who are probably the only kids who are in the library attempting to, like, uncover information about something. So the only thing I would say is they are specifically attempting to unearth what is otherwise a kind of, like, very obvious Hogwarts-centric secret that's happening at the moment. So maybe they are just, like, going and poking around and like pulling books that don't seem to like make any sense. Because if you're the librarian, you know that these students are pulling books that are not related to their coursework.
Right.
And so on some level, maybe Madam Pince is over there like, what are they? Like, I know they have no business being over there.
Yes. But at the same time, all the books they're pulling are just like history, like modern history books, basically.
Yeah.
It's not like necessarily nefarious. It's not like unusual potions of the 20th century or anything.
I do find it to be kind of interesting that is like a little wink a little bit that all the books in particular that they're pulling all happen to be like witches and wizards of the modern age.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
like because he's Nicholas Flamel is like 600 some year
right.
years old.
So, so the problem is that like he's too old to be showing up in. Yeah, they all have like a modifier that makes them recent. It says great wizards of the 20th century. century. Notable magical names of our time, and then important modern magical discoveries, recent developments in wizardry. It's like, yeah.
What is the thing? Like, because there's another modifier that we'll eventually learn about with the history of magic by Bathilda Bagshot, where it's like, yeah, she didn't cover anything after the 19th century. You know, it's like she's a historian, right, not a, like, in the, up until very recently, at least, probably even as of the chapter we're reading right now, is still alive.
Yeah.
And so, like, she's doing a history of magic, not a modern retelling of what just happened.
Right.
Yeah, that's the news.
Yeah.
she'll wait like 200 years for somebody else to be a historian to tell the secrets of today. Anyway, so as we jumped ahead a little bit, so let's move slower.
Yes.
There is a scene that actually is like a little bit like joyous here, which is that Malfoy is attempting to use his influence to spread sort of like negative feelings towards Harry, you know, basically making jokes about how the Gryffindor Quidditch team might replace him with a wide mouth tree frog because Harry caught the snitch with his mouth. But I love the fact that it's like, then he'd realize that nobody found this funny because they were also impressed the way Harry managed to stay on his bucking broomstick. And it's just like, we don't get many situations like this where Malfoy is actually like sort of like put back in his place.
Yeah,
like,
right.
It seems like most of the time Malfoy's propaganda against Harry just works.
It does. It does normally seem like that. Like, this isn't even like, even the Slytherins, it's like, what are you making fun of him? It's like, he's like, he hasn't really gotten good at like bullying Harry just yet or something. Like,
he's still honing his skills.
I'm still honing my skills. Right. He's like, I'm going to make fun of Potter for catching the snitch. Wait.
He did beat us.
But he did beat Slytherin by catching the snitch.
Yeah.
Right. So, okay, new tack.
Yeah, his new tack is, so Malfoy, jealous and angry, had gone back to taunting Harry about having no proper family.
Feels which, like... Too far in the other direction. Overcorrection, Malfoy.
It is an overcorrection. Yeah. This is like one of those where I'm like, Malfoy should have like lost some serious street cred in the process, because that is like, I don't care who you are and I don't care how mean other kids are at high school. I don't feel like people go this far. This is too far.
It is way too far.
It's blatantly mean.
Yeah.
So anyway, I could see the end of the sentence and I wrote the note mean and I was like, yeah, but Malfoy's always mean. But I'm like, no, you know what? That's just mean.
It is.
That's, you know, even for him.
Right. But I love that even it's also as way overcorrected it is, it's still ineffective against Harry because it says he didn't feel sorry for himself at all.
Yeah,
that he'd be
go.
Staying at Hogwarts for Christmas. I also like that it's Harry, we know, obviously is at Hogwarts, and then it says Ron and his brothers were staying too because Mr. and Mrs. Weasley were going to Romania to visit Charlie. This to me feels super duper on purpose that like, because this is Ron, like if you're Molly and Arthur, you've just sent your youngest son to his first year at Hogwarts.
Right.
Like they have not seen Ron, their 11-year-old son, since September. And they're like, nah, just stay.
Right. We'll go and visit our adult son.
Our adult son. Right. Yeah. We're going to go do that. Like this is 1000% Molly and Arthur being like, boys, you need to stay with Harry.
Yeah. And I had two different thoughts about this. One of them was that like, thank goodness for Harry that somebody stayed back so that like he had friends for like his first Christmas away from the Dursleys.
Absolutely.
Like, that is like, that's so joyous. But the other one is that Hermione actually goes home.
I know.
Which is like one of those things where I often feel like as sweet and kind and caring as Hermione Granger is, there can be no doubt that like from the time she like leaves for Hogwarts, her poor parents basically don't see her again.
Yeah, no. I mean, they get to see her this Christmas, but after this, it's like, sorry, Mom and Dad, I don't really like skiing. I'd rather do homework.
My friends need me.
Yeah.
Like, that's like one of those things, right? I mean, it's great. Like, I'm glad that Hermione puts her friends, you know, like holds them in such high regard and everything, but it is almost comical how at all times it's like you really always sort of need to bend the rules enough so that Harry, Ron, and Hermione can be doing things together over the holidays. But when you zoom back, it's like as a now parent, the thought of like Addie even going to like giving me all the way up until she's 18 and potentially leaving for college or whatever.
Yeah.
But if she left for college and didn't come home
Until
she was like through her senior year, I would be like, devastated.
Yeah, I'd be like, wow, good to see you.
Yeah, no, but, yeah. No, but at that point in time, if I hadn't seen her for 4 years, I'd be like, it is so good to see you. I missed you so much.
Right.
Thank you for coming back.
Thanks for coming back.
Anyway, yeah, so, but you're absolutely right again, to back to Dumbledore's boot camp. They're in the dungeons for potions where they can literally like see their breath, you know, in front of their face. Mm-hmm. And then they stumble across Hagrid carrying in the 12 Christmas trees for the holiday feast. So kind of the folks at Hogwarts to give each student who stayed behind
their own Christmas tree. Also good to know that boot camp extends to the staff as well, because it always is hilarious to me that Hagrid has to drag in 12 Christmas trees, which are enormous, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
It's just like, why should Hagrid have to do this when magic exists?
Right.
You're manually making this man carry trees. Like, even for Hagrid, have you ever tried to lift a tree? Because trees are heavy.
Mighty dense.
Tree, but you know what's not heavy? Magic's not heavy. All anyone has to do is be like, Wingardium Leviosa. And it's in. Cool. Thanks, Hagrid.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
The fact, especially because Hagrid has his wand. It's like put on this charade.
Charade.
Trees.
Hagrid, what are you doing, man?
He's like, Professor Dumbledore, could I please? No, Hagrid. We must keep up appearances.
There's your quirky Dumbledore.
There he is. Yeah, there
quirky
he is.
Dumbledore who runs boot camp.
Yeah, I know. Hagrid, are you finished manually dragging the trees in yet?
Oh my gosh. But so yeah, okay, so they run into Hagrid, who they're chatting with, and then once again Malfoy pops up and starts just like slinging mud again, because apparently he hasn't had enough of it today. And right as Ron is diving at Malfoy, Snape comes up the stairs, and I just wrote down, Harry and Ron have the worst timing and will continue to have the worst timing, because a teacher will find them on the wrong side of every single attack for the rest of their schooling like life.
Not that it even matters. I mean, Hagrid is there to watch the entire exchange, and he's just like, whoa, Snape, just so you know, that was totally warranted. And Snape's like, shut up, Hagrid.
Yeah, but he still takes 5 points from them. It's like, okay, Snape, you know what? Another Hogwarts staff member literally just vouched for these people. It's like, I think you need to let it go. And he's like, nah, 5 points anyway. Yeah. This is one of those things where people always make the joke how at the end of the year, Dumbledore goes through and he's just like, 50 points to Harry, 50 points to Hermione. Oh, it's actually 60 to
60
Harry.
To Harry, yeah. He's more important.
I caught myself. But like, everybody is always sort of like, well, how much does Gryffindor need to beat Slytherin? Okay, I can figure this out. I'll math. Yep, no problem. Mm-hmm. But to be fair, like, I almost feel like what Dumbledore is actually doing is like, yeah, Snape took off like a buttload of points throughout the year.
He's so like looking at the ledger. He's like, okay.
Yeah, this is like me in fantasy football, where you get to the end of the season and you see that I've made the most waiver wire moves.
Yeah.
It's like some people, it's like, oh, they made 6 moves, you know, like 7 moves, 5 moves, stuff like that. And there's Ben, it's like 39 moves. as a piece of data, it stands out a lot. So if he has the ledger and he's sort of like, okay, who deducted the most points? Oh, it was Snape, and always to Gryffindor. How about that? How about that?
It's not even. Yeah. You need to give it back. Although, I mean, to be fair, McGonagall takes off 150 points from Gryffindor herself.
That is true. Nobody's harder on Gryffindor other than Snape and McGonagall.
I know. McGonagall's really not helping the Gryffindors out in the House Cup race.
That's the thing. She's just like, if we're going to earn it, we're going to earn it.
We're going to earn it, people. And Snape's like, okay, I'm obviously not taking points from my house.
Right.
Duh. Yeah. That seems obvious. Minerva.
Yeah. Rule number one, don't be your own, your own blockade.
You almost should, like, it almost feels like the professors shouldn't be allowed to award points from to their own house.
It does feel
or,
that
or
way.
Like, yeah. Or if you're the head of house, you shouldn't be allowed to award points to your house.
So that's the other thing too. Yeah. So like, McGonagall says, is it McGonagall who says like, Snape never let me live it down, you know, because Slytherin's won the House Cup for the past 7 years. It's like, is it possible that Snape is just continuously giving his house more points?
Oh, I know. Like, the point totals are right there on the wall. It's just like, Slytherin's losing by 40. Oh, Malfoy, that's an epic charm you just did. 41 points for Slytherin.
And that'll do it.
Look at that. The clock's run out. Oh my goodness, we won again. Hooray!
How about that? Yeah, I know. It's like McGonagall, this is an easy solve.
Yeah, I know. Like, you can, I mean, yeah, that it does seem like there needs to be some sort of checks and balances on the point system.
It does feel that way. Yeah. It does feel that way. That's okay, though. But especially because it's Christmas.
It is, yeah.
So what do we have next then here? We have the decoration of the Great Hall, yep. which always sounds just truly amazing with Professor Flitwick's golden bubbles.
Trivia blossom. Question.
Yeah, that is a good trivia question. Yeah. Did you highlight that? Or you
I did. I just wrote, yeah, I just highlighted golden bubbles and was like, that's a trivia thing right there.
One of my least favorite trivia questions that we always get is sort of like, which of these was not a decoration at the, you know, end of year feast or whatever. It's like, oh man, I don't, you know, they list
remember the decor.
There's a lot of, you know, icing on this cake, so to speak. It's hard to remember all the, mm-hmm. all the individual things,
but yeah.
either which way. So then, you know, Harry, Ron and Hermione are telling, Hagrid about how ever since you mentioned Nicholas Flamel, we've been trying to figure out who he is. And Hagrid's just like, what? No.
No.
I've told you it's nothing. But yeah, so then they're like, you know, then Harry's like, oh, you just want to tell us and save us all the trouble? And Hagrid's like, no.
Yeah.
Oh, good times. Good times.
Hilarious. It is almost, it is humorous to me that he doesn't even show up in like Great Wizards of the 20th Century. Because like you'd think Dumbledore would still show up in books like that. And like even on Dumbledore's Chocolate Frog card, like if you can choose where you get like, five sentences. Like
right.
one of the sentences is he knows Nicholas Flamel and did alchemy with him. So you'd right. think if there was like an entire, you know, chapter or page dedicated to Dumbledore, it would also mention Nicholas Flamel.
Yeah, I mean, even just simply important modern magical discoveries, like one way or another, I think the celebration of one's 600th birthday, like each century birthday would count as its own like reason to
yeah.
to inscribe this accolade inside of a book. So
yeah.
Anyway, yeah, that's one where as ever, you know, it's this will also come up. See Goblet of Fire, second task where they can't find Gillyweed.
Oh, that
in any of the books.
Yeah, this one I'll let slide because there is a fun little like, oh no, all the books were too recent, like thing in there. But that they cannot find not just Gillyweed, but a way to breathe underwater at all.
Right, right. I mean, the other
bananas.
Students. Yeah, it's like they like literally. If you're like a seventh year at Hogwarts, you know about the bubblehead charm.
Yeah,
like, there is a textbook talking about the bubblehead charm.
Like, I mean,
Harry's a fourth year. He's not that far away from just learning
the
spell.
I know, and like breathing underwater is something Muggles have figured out. You know?
Right. Oh yeah,
it's
yeah.
Like the ability to go beneath the surface is absolutely just like even kindergartners know about scuba diving.
Right.
So it would be like it's like 5-year-old wizards should know about the bubblehead charm or whatever mechanism there is for going underwater.
Right.
Because it's just such a thing that needs solving that should be easily solved.
Yep, yeah. But either which way, yeah, you know, Harry gets kicked out of the library, and then it just says 5 minutes later, Ron and Hermione joined him, shaking their heads. They went off to lunch. This is like one of those where I'm like, why didn't Ron and Hermione just leave, like at the same time as Harry? Yeah. It's like, yeah, Harry gets kicked out, and then they stayed for 5 more minutes.
You're like,
it's like just leave together.
Harry's really the glue that holds the whole friendship together.
Right, Hermione and Ron are like, this is weird.
hi.
You want to like maybe like 7 years from now have a romantic interest or something?
Yeah, you want to get like married later on or something?
Yeah, we'll get there when we get there.
We'll get there.
Yeah. Anyway, so then Hermione then does of course leave after we learned that both of her parents are dentists,
yep.
which is you know always great to know.
Yeah.
It's
funny that they say make sure you ask them if they know who Nicholas Flamel is because like they could know.
Oh yeah, that's
you
a good
know,
point.
Like yep. you know, Nicholas Flamel is a known name here in the Muggle world.
It is yeah. out here
for this reason,
right? Nicholas Flamel is in fact was in fact a real person.
Yeah,
he did not actually discover the Philosopher's Stone, but he was a real person.
Yes,
that's not just a made up name. But yeah, so then the holiday festivities have begun after Hermione takes off to go back to Dentist Land.
Yep, I love when they're sitting there roasting stuff on the fire and the examples that are given for the. It says they. They sat by for an hour eating anything they could spear on a roasting fork. Bread, English muffins, marshmallows. These are the three things.
These are the
anything things. They could find. Basically, bread, more bread, or marshmallows.
Yes, yes. And I you know, I looked this up because I was just curious because I was like, you know, and there's like a kind of basic irony to it, but simply English muffins is replaced in the British copy with crumpets.
Oh.
Where crumpets, I think, are for all intents and purposes similar, like they are described as just like the British version of English muffins. So
still
fairly similar, but it is interesting to me that English muffins is not a British thing.
That's true.
You know?
Well, I guess that makes sense because over there they'd just be muffins. Apparently they're crumpets.
That's a good, they're crumpets instead. Yeah. So anyway, but yeah, I have often thought the exact same thing. Also, like, you know, marshmallows are a very commonly like roasted on fire type of thing, but I never in my life have actually, I am backtracking immediately as I was going to say. I was going to say, I don't think I've ever toasted bread over a fire, but when we were kids, do you remember we had a grilled cheese?
I do remember it now that you're saying it. Yes, there was like, you could put like a grilled cheese sandwich in this little cast iron thing and hold it over the fire and it would cook it, I guess.
It was pretty neat.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But okay, this is just bread.
This is just bread on stick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ron, get over here. Look what I can do.
Toast.
I'm toasting bread. on a fire.
The novelties of the magical world.
I know. Good. Speaking of which, I love that wizard chest is just chess.
Is just chess.
And I love that it's chess that's almost harder to play.
Because the chess pieces themselves sort of have like a measure of their own sentience, and they're sort of like they can like argue with you or sort of plead on their own behalf.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, you go over there like, I don't want to, I'm gonna die. And it's like, yeah, you're being sacrificed, friend. Get over there. And it's like, I don't think we need to do that.
Right.
It almost just seems like it'd be easier to play regular chess.
And the question I always have, though, is that, like, I feel like one accolade we absolutely can grant to Ron is that he seems to actually genuinely be good at chess.
Oh, I know. I felt like this, it seems like when you read this book, like, this is going to be Ron's thing. It's like, if you ever watch Avatar, The Last Airbender, it's like, you know, Aang is the Avatar, and he can basically fight anyone and always win. And Katara is, like, the world's greatest waterbender, and she's, like, super good and has, like, healing abilities and stuff like that. Like, they are better in a fight than, like, Sokka, who is the brother who cannot bend anything.
Right.
But, without doubt, it is, like, it is proven how invaluable Sokka is, because as good as the other two at fighting, they are not good at strategy. And he's always got a plan and, like, is, like, a key factor to the success. And it feels like Ron is being set up for that role. It's like, oh yeah, Harry, super powerful wizard, has got all the power levels up. Patronus, great. Expelliarmus, great. But Ron has to like formulate where everyone's going to go and strike and stuff.
And you know, when you look at the three of them, I sort of gave that like that rock, paper, scissors example, where it sort of seems like each one of their like inefficiencies is made up by somebody else's like abilities.
Yeah.
You know, this almost sort of to me makes sense. Like Harry is central. He is, you know, sort of that like proverbial chosen one. He is exemplary at defense against the dark arts. Then you've got like Hermione, who is just like incredible. Like she's like a wealth of knowledge. I mean, she's like a walking like Wikipedia where she can just like pull information. But like it does almost seem like there is the obvious trajectory where then like Ron can sort of be like the person who like maybe doesn't have all the information, maybe doesn't have all the abilities, but does like it, like is able to take the essential bits and sort of like formulate or help craft sort of like the plan, the objective, like where we go from here. And it seems like that is exactly what this like chess accolade is supposed to be ultimately granting him. But I'm wondering or curious if like as you're writing this particular character, if it doesn't too quickly become the case that like Ron almost feels like the mastermind. Like the issue is that if you give him too much of the ability, he almost like ends up inadvertently like casting a shadow.
Right.
Because so much of what they're running into is usually dealing with some measure of the unknown. So if Ron is really good at like combating the unknown and you like let that skill fly, then all of a sudden like you lose a lot of like even like them looking for Nicholas Flamel or Gillyweed, for example. Like,
yeah.
You know, this is like one of these things where it's like they can't find a solution, and part of them not finding a solution is what drives the plot forward.
Right, exactly. But it feels like Ron should, it feels like the sort of thing that Ron should just know because he's the one with all the wizarding world knowledge.
Exactly.
And kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Like he can fill in a lot of the gaps that the other two like have their deficiencies at.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But that doesn't really end up being the case necessarily as we move forward.
It's more like he's just good at chess, and which I do like that like Hermione cannot beat him at chess like ever.
Yes. That like is really cool.
It is a running character trait, and it feels like she should be able to beat him. Like she should be able to think her way through it because that's the sort of thing she's good at. But he's like, nope, I got it. I always can see what you're, I always see it coming.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yep. And so with that being said, again, we mentioned a little bit like the whole concept of Dumbledore's big plan, you know, at the beginning of the episode today. But this, the chess piece, like, and we'll see more examples of it throughout this particular chapter, but the chess piece is one of those where it's like, if, like, on some level we are being granted access to the specific skills that, like, each of these characters on some level embodies that ultimately become the obstacles that we see towards the end of the book.
Yeah.
And this is another one of those where it's like, are the obstacles specifically curated to sort of like match the abilities of Harry and company? And it feels like, you know, you got like a one for one with chess.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's just a dead ringer. And then the other one is, of course, the fact that Harry has just been made seeker. And one of the challenges is
catching a winged key. Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, we got that one, and we'll get more as we continue to go. One of the cool things I think is kind of fun is that, like, on Christmas Eve, it says Harry went to bed looking forward to the next day for the food and for the fun, but not expecting any presents at all. What's kind of neat about this is that, like, especially through the lens of your typical 11-year-old, the gifts very often are what make Christmas incredibly fun. Like, you know, as an 11-year-old, not that you're never, like, you're not excited to see your family, you know, your extended family, grandparents, right, stuff like that. But I feel like the at least from my own personal experiences, it felt like the big draw was like, oh my gosh, like, you know,
right,
Christmas morning, gifts, like presents, you know, there's like fun, excitement. I mean, you know, there's food and candy and like that type, yeah, of stuff as well. But I do love the fact that, like, you know, with no expectation of gifts at all, Harry is just like joyous.
Right. Yeah.
You know, this is fun. This is exciting. And it either which way, he ends up getting gifts, and
he sure does,
rather special ones.
I know. He's surprised by it. Oh, man, it's like, will you look at this? I've got some presents. It was like, oh, Harry.
Harry.
Never got a gift before.
I just want to give him a hug.
I know.
What did you expect? Turnips? Hey, wait a second. Turnips. No. Oh, my gosh. Okay, on a recent Jay versus Ben, we had the question that was, what is the first Birdie Bot bean
sprouts
that Ron eats? And yeah, the answer is sprouts, but I put turnips.
Oh,
in our recent Jay versus Ben, this is what he said. This is when he says
this.
It
is where it is.
So it's like literally my brain like chose a word that was correct, and Ron does say it.
But I think we had a question about what did he say, or we had like a fill in the blank quiz once upon a time, and this was like, what did you expect? Blank?
Right. Yeah, yeah. You're right.
and then that one was turnips, but I think we got that one wrong too.
Probably so. Yeah, it's a very obscure detail anyway.
It is.
but yeah, so Harry also gets another little nod, if you will, from Hagrid as to how he will be able to eventually tackle the obstacles for the Philosopher's Stone in the form of the roughly cut wooden flute from Hagrid, which that one, again, is a one-to-one because you literally need to play music to put Fluffy to bed.
Yep.
And Fluffy belongs to Hagrid, and the flute came from Hagrid.
Yeah. Feels like maybe Dumbledore's like, hey, give him a flute.
yeah, right. It's like, Hagrid, if you're looking for something, I'm just spitballing here.
Yeah.
Here's an idea.
You've got some time after you're done with the trees. How are you at whittling flutes?
Right. And can you make them sound like an owl?
Yeah.
Which incidentally is the other gift that Hagrid has given Harry.
That's true.
Hedwig.
Yeah. Maybe he could have just bought Hedwig.
Do what?
Maybe, like, if Harry had just brought Hedwig, could Hedwig have sung Fluffy to sleep?
Oh, that's a good question.
Ooh,
that's a good question. Yeah.
I love how fascinated Ron is with the shape of the money, the 50-cent piece, which that was one of those where it was like, what a shape. This is money? I was like, does this say more about the shape of wizard gold or of English currency?
Did you look up what a 50-pence piece looked like?
I did, and it is seven-sided.
What you mean by set.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes, so it is an unusual shape, but to me I was like, am I gonna look this up and it'd be like a round coin, and does that mean that wizard coins are not round?
Yeah. I know, if anything, it feels like inside of this story, if there were coins of different shapes that were not round, they would have seven sides.
Yeah, it almost feels more wizardy to have a seven-sided coin.
Yes. When in doubt, inside of Harry Potter trivia, the answer is seven,
right?
Especially if the question has something to do with a number.
Yeah.
Let's see here. So, and then what else do we have?
They get the sweaters. This is one of those things where, like, because they always describe the Gryffindor colors as being like scarlet.
Yes.
Like to me, like when the scarlet's very much, I think, like the English word for red, basically.
It's like a very vibrant, bright red.
Yeah. Yeah. But so like when I was a kid, I always thought of the Gryffindor colors as basically just being maroon and gold.
I agree.
Like I always thought of scarlet as more maroon, which it's not. It was just like a misunderstanding. But so Ron's complaint, I always remember thinking it was dumb that Ron complained that he got a maroon sweater. I'm like, but you got a Gryffindor colored sweater. Like, what's the problem?
Exactly.
Exactly. What are you complaining about?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like, but I mean, it is interesting as well because, it seems like this continues to happen with Ron and Molly, where it seems like for some reason, like, Ron just is always on the Molly fails to remember certain things about what's important to Ron.
Right, like he doesn't like the corned beef sandwiches.
He doesn't like the corned beef sandwiches.
And doesn't like maroon.
Doesn't like maroon. And then also, like, you know, his dress robes eventually end up kind of being, like, a little bit, like more sad. But, like, you never really hear about, like, Fred and George's dress robes being
right,
sad,
exactly. Know? Or Ginny's. Or I guess, yeah.
Ginny got, like, a dress, you know? So, yeah. It's, you know. But, like, that's even one of those, where, like, it's like, Ginny's a third year. She's not even supposed
to be going. Yeah.
Right, yeah. She got asked by an upperclassman. Oh, yeah. Classic Ginny. Anyway.
Classic indeed.
Yep. So, but then of course, Harry also receives his own emerald green sweater, which sounds very cozy.
Right. Is this the one that has the snitch on it? No. It's just an emerald green sweater.
Just an emerald green sweater. Yeah. Which on that note, neither Harry nor Ron have anything on their sweater, but both Greta and Forge do.
They sure do. I love that joke. I remember where it happens on the next page. He says, I suppose she thinks you don't forget your name, but we're not stupid. We know we're called Greta and Forge.
Yes.
I just remember that being the best joke I had ever heard.
When I can remember Dad saying those words as he read this to us as kids. It's like, yep, nope, 100%. That's totally it.
Yep.
So that's a good one. And once again, Fred and George just really standing out as some of, like, my favorite characters in the story. There's just always a hooting and hollering good time.
Yeah, they show up. They show up so much more than you think they do.
I know. Yeah. I've always said this, and this is like whenever we get the question of, like, you know, if they were to do a more long form, which it sounds like maybe is coming anyway, but longer form Harry Potter TV series, what would you want? And I've always sort of said that I feel like you could explore other characters more.
Yeah.
So, like, you could leave Harry, Ron, and Hermione and show other aspects about, like, what's going on. Or, like, maybe you've got, like, a Dumbledore side story and a Fred and George side story and then, like, the Golden Trio.
Yeah.
Like, main story.
You definitely need that. Like, would you show, like, Fred and George with the map in year one?
I think so.
Oh, yeah. That'd be very interesting.
It might be kind of fun if you showed it subtly, because this is one of those for, like, first-time viewers. It'd be neat if you didn't know that what they were doing was using the Marauders.
Oh, like, yeah, you just see them constantly, like, putting away a piece of parchment.
Yes.
That, like, you, the experienced watcher or, like, reader knows, like, oh, that was the map.
That was the thing.
But, like, obviously they can't, like, name it or, like, give it its moment in the spotlight until they give it to Harry.
Exactly. So I think use patience. If anybody's asking my advice, use patience. Mm-hmm. Let it get there organically, but also, like, include as many, like, little nods.
Yes, absolutely. Like, hint out those things.
Yes, for sure. Of course, the next extremely important gift that is handed over during this Christmas holiday is the one, the only, invisibility cloak.
The cloak of invisibility. Man, this is one of those that, like, as I was reading through it this time, it's like the impact it must be for Harry to, like, get the note that says, your father left this in my possession before he died. It's like for Harry, he has probably never even considered the idea. Like, one, we find out later in this chapter, he doesn't know what they look like. Oh my gosh. Like, it's so easy to bash on the Dursleys in the first couple of chapters, but oh my God, they've never shown him a picture of his parents.
Like, I know.
What? It is crazy. That is bananas. Oh my God, it makes me so mad. But, like, so to him, I mean, he doesn't even know what they look like. So the idea that, like, he would ever own something that belonged to them probably is, like, extremely foreign. Like, I can't imagine what it feels like reading that note. And then to not know who it came from.
Oh, I know. Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, like, even like Harry, there's a couple of good moments, I feel like, inside of this chapter where Harry is almost having these, they're like, the kind of correct amount of like mingled feelings where he's like happy but overwhelmed and also kind of sad at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's the same thing after he sees, you know, he's like, he doesn't want to eat like breakfast after, you know, like once he finally finds the mirror.
Yeah.
You know? And I feel like this is sort of, you know, like a similar thing. So I'd give anything for one of these. He said, anything. What's the matter? Nothing, said Harry. He felt very strange. Who had sent him the cloak? Had it once really belonged to his father? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, it's just like you can sort of imagine like the overall sort of mixed sensations that you'd be feeling here. Like, cause I mean, he does not see this coming. This is a total surprise, but like not in a like, oh my gosh, I'm jumping up and down on the top of my bed because this is like the greatest day of my life because I just got a gift. Like,
right.
You know, it's like, it's a very, very different kind of experience. But then just right on cue, Fred and George sort of arrive, you know, just sort of lighten the mood with their F&G sweaters, which is good stuff. I love the fact that it said Harry's is better than ours though, said Fred, holding up Harry's sweater. She obviously makes more of an effort if you're not family.
Yeah. This is another thing I thought was interesting is that when the invisibility cloak is revealed, like, and it falls on the floor, Ron is able to like identify it like immediately.
Oh yeah.
Which is sort of unusual because like we know later on in the story that like other kinds of invisibility cloaks exist, like cloaks that have been imbued with like a disillusionment charm or that have been made out of demiguy's hair or something like that. But like, so other cloaks do exist, like it's a known object to exist, but this one in particular should not like fit any description that Ron has heard before, because like this is the invisibility cloak.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. No, I agree with you. And the thing, I mean, it's a really good point. And so I have mixed thoughts, because part of me is like, well, maybe it like wasn't fully established like how unique this particular one is. Mm-hmm. But also the description that we get from it is Harry picked the shining silvery cloth off the floor. It was strange to touch, like water woven into material. And something about that description just like, it does demonstrate to me that like this is a truly unique garment.
Yeah.
Like this is different.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And there's like little things that aren't really mentioned about it. Like it's never, there's things about the cloak that don't get attention drawn to them, but like there's many times where like Harry stuffs the cloak in his pocket or something, and it's like you don't think about that because it just sounds like, yeah, he just folded it up and put it in there. Yeah, what's the big deal? And it's like, just imagine though, you're wearing, you know, your jeans or something, and you take off your winter jacket and fold it up and put it into your pocket.
Right.
You know, it's like cloaks are massive pieces of clothing. Yeah. Like they don't fit in a pocket, but like there is a magical quality to the cloak that lets it be smaller than it should.
Yes. Yeah. No, I agree. And one of our other favorite, you know, fantasy series is of course Kingkiller Chronicles or Name of the Wind. And inside of that, you know, he does of course also receive what's called a shade.
Yeah.
And it seems like the shade, at least in fantasy, you know, also like abides by this sort of similar kind of magic where it's like, which makes me wonder like within fantasy, if it's sort of like, I have always read it to be implied that the cloak had some magical ability to break down, or else is of such a remarkably fine material that when folded is just very small. Mm-hmm. But then like the flip end of a fine material is usually that it's highly like, subject to tearing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not very durable. And in this case, it seems like the cloak absolutely is. Like it can withstand like a total beating and all the rest. So yeah, there's something just utterly remarkable. But I do agree, it does seem somewhat surprising that Ron would be able to recognize it. And maybe that's just sort of one of those like, we got to explain it somehow. Although that being said, I mean, all it would take was Harry putting it on.
Absolutely. Like, you know, yeah. Yeah. Our theory, because now that once you know it's one of the Deathly Hallows, it's like our theory personally about the cloak is that it is made out of like thestral hair.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, thestrals are invisible on their own. And then if you know that the Peveril brothers made the wand and the resurrection stone, then the Elder Wand has a core of a thestral.
It does.
Thestral tail hair. That's it. There we go. And then because it's like invisible, and it's a deathly hallow, and Thestrals have to do with death. It does seem like that could be like the source of it.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk about the mirror in a second, because we've also theorized that the mirror is related to the resurrection stone as well.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that in a second.
Yeah, we'll get to that. I was gonna say that's like one of my favorite theories.
Absolutely one of my favorite ones. Yeah.
But as long as we're talking about garments from our family members, one of the things I do love is this is another line from Fred of George that just totally stood out, but it's the come on, get it on. They're lovely and warm. Like I love the way that, like, you know, there they are receiving their like annual gift that is the same gift, and they're still referring to these sweaters as lovely and warm.
Yeah, lovely and warm. Yeah, where is it? I think I did I thought I had like highlighted that exact line, but because I thought that was a funny way to do.
Yes,
put it on. They're lovely and warm.
They're lovely. Yeah, and then, but I mean, they sort of back it up a little bit too. Again, another good Fred and George moment is, and you're not sitting with a prefix today either. This is of course talking to Percy. Said George, Christmas is a time for family. Like, this is one of those where it's like Fred and George rag on Percy basically relentlessly.
Yeah,
but like in this particular instance, they're like insisting, like, no, you were sitting with us at dinner tonight, like,
right? Yeah,
you know, it's like there no ifs, ands, or buts about it,
right? Yeah, like they do give him a hard time, but they do like love him as their brother.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that's just kind of like a nice special moment.
Through the Gryffindor is supported by Pear Eyewear. Y'all, I am so excited for our upcoming Through the Gryffin tour. It is going to be such a good time. But as ever, when you're going to be spending time in front of people, you want to be looking your darned best. And let me tell you what, Pear Eyewear has arrived just in the nick of time. Like, honestly, I was immediately blown away with my new frame. So let me walk you through exactly what they do. So starting at just $60, including your prescription, you can get your base frames, which are like sleek, modern, and stylish. But that is really just the start, because from there, you get to fully customize each frame, all of your looks, by simply snapping on the top frames. And they actually have an entire collection of Harry Potter frames. So like for the upcoming tour, I was so pumped, because I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to find some super cool Slytherin frames that I can like wear. But then as I was clicking around, I've been watching X-Men 97, which is like so good. And they actually had X-Men frames as well. And then May the 4th is coming up, or maybe by the time you're listening, it's already passed. But like, they have a huge collection of over 20 Star Wars frames as well. So I had a very hard time narrowing, and I ended up getting two. I got the X-Men ones and I got some Slytherin ones. So many different like fandom frames you can choose from. I never thought to accessorize my glasses with fandom stuff, but now you can. And it's so easy to change between them. Like, they have little magnets on them, so you can just slap a different frame onto the front of your glasses and then easily switch it out. I've been doing it all day. It's so fun. And before you commit to anything, you can explore all the different possibilities with their virtual try-on. But again, the base frames for men, women, or kids. I think, honestly, kids would love this, because you can just switch them out and they're so fun looking. They all start at $60. One pair, infinite possibilities. Go to PairEyewear.com and use code GRIFFIN for 15% off your first pair, and support the show by mentioning that Through the Gryffindor sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's PairEyewear.com, code GRIFFIN.
Through the Gryffindor is sponsored by Rosetta Stone. Y'all, I've got to say, I love international travel. I don't know if there's anything that opens your eyes and mind more to different walks of life than immersing yourself inside of new ones. But one hesitation I always have about going somewhere new is how to best navigate the differing languages. But that's where Rosetta Stone can help. Because for me, it's not just about like the fear of getting lost, although to be fair, it's not a concern either. But to me, the immersion goes so much further than simply being somewhere else. I want to engage with and respect the locale by communicating in their tongue, not my own. And that's what's so great about Rosetta Stone. They provide 25 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, and more. And they use such an intuitive approach designed for you to pick up the language naturally, so you're really learning to speak, listen, and the one I always find the most fascinating, think in a new language. And what's even better is that when you sign up, it's for life. Yeah, a lifetime membership, because let's face it, we can only travel to so many new places, but so fast. But with all the time in the world, you can be ready for any adventures ahead. ahead. Don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Through the Gryffindor listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off your unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah.
Then we, of course, get to such Christmas
dinner.
Yeah. With 100 fat roast turkeys.
100.
Mountains of roast and boiled potatoes, platters of chipolatas.
Multiple kinds of potatoes, as always.
Yeah. Chipolatas, tureens of buttered peas, silver boats of thick, rich gravy and cranberry sauce. It sounds amazing.
It does. Like, it makes me so hungry.
Yeah. I'm like literally salivating just like kind of describing it. The other kind of cool thing that I like on behalf of Hogwarts is the fact that they're the stacks of wizard crackers every few feet along the table. This is kind of neat because I feel like it's also one of those areas where like you know, Harry ultimately ends up like leaving, you know, with a set of wizard chessmen.
Yeah.
You know, so like it's almost like a way to ensure that like if you're a student who stayed behind, it's kind of like a conscious awareness that like if you stayed behind, it might mean that you're not receiving or don't have, you know, like the family to go back to have a holiday. So I like the fact that the crackers are not both like festive, but it's also like a way to like, you know, for the school
you
to sort
something.
Of, you got some gifts.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like, you know, just neat. I had to look up what a Rear Admiral's hat is just because.
It's like a military hat, right?
It is a military hat. Yeah. And I mean, like if it was just a Admiral's hat, I would have had no questions whatsoever.
Right, yeah.
I was like, rear. Why? A Rear Admiral's hat? It's just an actual position.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, that's just simply it. Like in the Navy, there's just the Rear Admiral.
Yeah, the Rear Admiral. Got to charge the back of the boat.
Back of the boat, sure. Yeah, why not? Also, there's the scene where flaming Christmas pudding followed the turkey. Percy nearly broke his teeth on a silver sickle embedded in the slice. I looked this up, and this is a common British tradition to bake items into like the holiday puddings.
Oh, the cake, yeah.
Yeah, yep. So that is not just sort of like what's the sickle doing in there? It's like this is something that would be like, you know, pretty common.
That's cool.
Yeah, so I thought that was kind of neat. You get like a scene that doesn't seem like it would make sense in any other book, especially the more you get to know the characters. But Hagrid getting redder and redder in the face as he called for more wine, finally kissing Professor McGonagall on the cheek, who, to Harry's amazement, giggled and blushed, her top hat lopsided. It's like, I feel like the more we get to know these characters, the less likely that seems like that would happen.
I know, right? Yeah.
But that's okay. Good.
That's okay. Still fun. Everyone just having a good Christmas dinner.
Yep. Love both of them.
Yep.
Harry, of course, then gets his non-explodable luminous balloons and grow your own warts kit, which is like one of those things where I'm like, some of these gifts, including his wizard chest set, are cool. The grow your own warts kit, I'm like, why would you want that?
And what is this? Actually, there was on Disney Plus this year, they released a new like Mickey Mouse Halloween. It's like a claymation sort of thing.
Okay.
That my kids watched a bunch of times, and like the bad guy, quote unquote, is like this witch who turns them all into their costumes.
Okay.
So like, you know, I think like Minnie becomes an actual spider.
Oh,
and Daisy and Donald are the princess and the frog. So Donald gets turned into a frog and Daisy gets turned into a princess, and she keeps joking like, this worked out for me.
I'm fine with this.
Anyway, there's one scene where the witch is like getting ready for everyone to get there, and she pulls out some like wart cream and she like puts it on her nose and all the warts like pop up and she's like, works as advertised. And I was like, that's pretty funny. she wants warts because she's a witch.
Yeah, I see. Oh yeah. It's part of the appearance. You gotta have it. We have our furious snowball fight on the grounds. Then they have more food, which also sounds good. Meal of turkey sandwiches, crumpets. Wait, Crumpets. Was that the word from earlier?
Oh, wait. Yeah. So they have English muffins and crumpets.
Hey, wait a second.
Wait a minute.
We know that word. Yeah, there you go. So English muffins earlier, but just went for straight for crumpets this time. Trifle and Christmas cake. Everyone felt full and sleepy. This is just like, I mean, just a total aside, but I feel like there is sort of this like snow day sensation of like being out in the cold, having so much fun, but like being in the snow is exhausting.
It is. Yeah.
Like, you know, especially if you're like sledding or like, or having a snowball fight and like running up and down a hill. Or whatever. And there is like a warm, like sleepy, dreamy state that I feel like I can like go back to from my childhood that just makes me think of this particular moment. So
absolutely.
I just like that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, at this point in time, you know, Harry is just basically like, I think he is struggling to sleep and he is thinking about the cloak from his father, and specifically in the note. And this is another one of those like Dumbledore's big plan nods where he specifically uses the phrase, use it well. And like, this is like one of those things where like, if you're the headmaster of the school and you have just given one of the students quite literally a Deathly Hallow,
yeah, which
I mean, that aside, still just an invisibility cloak, and encouraging the usage of said cloak.
Yeah.
Like this by itself suggests to me that like Dumbledore is like, I am giving you this now. Now is the time to use it.
Right.
Like,
and
like,
I mean, that is going to be doubled down later in the chapter as well.
Yes, it 100% is.
Yeah.
And Harry seems to basically just sort of like, inherently understand this, like, you know, it's like he kind of knows like there's like a draw, a pull, like,
yeah,
he's taking like, those words.
I'm gonna try it. I love the sentence he says, you could go anywhere in this, anywhere, and Filch would never know. And it's like, yeah, you'd think that would be the case, Harry.
I know. The thing I wrote down too, because he's like, he could go anywhere in the castle that he wishes. And he goes to the library.
I know. I'm like, the library.
The restricted section. Yeah. Good times.
Yeah.
No, but it is kind of fun to me that I feel like of all things, like it's just like, yeah, he wants to go to the library.
He wants to go to the library.
If you're Dumbledore and you're sitting there waiting for him in the Mirror of Erised room.
Which he is.
And you're like, he went to the library. Oh, come on.
Also, like I imagined. Also, I love that Harry is in the library and he lit a lamp to see his way. And it says the lamp looked as if it was floating along in midair. And it's like, dude, that's kind of a giveaway. Like,
it is
what
a
is
bit
the
of
point
giveaway.
Of the cloak if you're going to hold something outside the cloak?
Right.
What are you
right.
doing?
Yep. You have anonymity in the event that somebody discovers you, I would say.
Yeah.
Which Dumbledore himself, when he does discover him, I think he makes like a comment, something along the lines of how strange how nearsighted being invisible can make you, said Dumbledore. You know, which I think is sort of like maybe exactly what we're witnessing happen in this on this particular page here, is that he is Harry is failing to realize the obvious shortcomings because he's invisible. He's
right.
Like, I'm safe doing whatever I want, including having my hand half exposed.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
No one could see me.
Yep. There we go. He basically goes to the restricted section, cracks open one of the books, which immediately starts shrieking, which is, you know, it's basically like his first foray with invisibility cloaking is,
I know,
backfiring rather tremendously.
I was wondering, it doesn't like say how he like sets the, like, chooses the book. It just has a large black and silver volume caught his eye. Like, I was curious as I was reading that, if we ever come across this book again later on, like, because like, could this have been like one of the Horcrux books or something like that?
It totally feels like it could be.
Yeah, like I would need to go check the description of whenever they get evil most or yeah,
magic most evil.
Yeah, magic most evil or whatever. Yeah,
because that is the book itself.
That'd be such a fun detail if like Harry like accidentally like put like, oh, this one drew it, like he was drawn to it because it was like about Horcruxes.
No, that would be straight up fascinating.
That'd be great.
And that literally could just be the. I mean, if he's got the piece of Tom Riddle's soul inside of him inside of this moment, then it means that Tom Riddle himself had previously held this book.
Exactly. So
it would guide him towards it. I like that.
Yeah.
That's just headcanon for me.
There it is. Yeah. That was magic most evil.
That was magic. Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally love that. Yeah. So anyway, he immediately causes such a loud stir, which then of course is another one of those instances where Filch is just apparently like out patrolling in the middle of the night. And even though he's also patrolling out in the middle of the day when the poor man sleeps.
Well, there is a little bit of a different one on this one because he goes to Snape and he says, you asked me to come directly to you, Professor, if anyone was wandering around at night and somebody's been in the library, restricted section. So it's like he is a little bit more out there, like on purpose. I guess. And it like occurred to me as I read this one that like Snape has asked Filch to come to him. So it's like, I wonder, like, what is, who is, like, Snape, we know, is on the lookout for Quirrell, though.
Yes.
So it's like, this trap with Filch is actually meant for Quirrell, not one of the students.
Yeah, I wrote the exact same note.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that to me, though, and we also know Dumbledore asked Snape to look for Quirrell or whatever. And Dumbledore, we also know that Dumbledore has put the mirror in the room that it's in, because he wants Harry to come find it.
Yes.
Right. So the mirror is a little bit more exposed and less protected on this night. So to me, the math is that Snape has Filch on the lookout for Quirrell because Dumbledore told Snape to look for Quirrell because Dumbledore knows that where the stone is hidden is a little bit more exposed on this night.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Even though Dumbledore himself is in the room with the mirror.
Even though Dumbledore himself. So, yeah, I mean, nobody's going to get past Dumbledore. But the other thing Dumbledore knows, and again, going back to Dumbledore's big plan, the thing is that nobody's ever going to defeat the mirror.
That's the other thing, too.
The mirror is like, literally, you know, this is the thing. It's like, what the obstacles really feel like to me, because it's like, what kind of logic is it that it's like, no, you can't steal this thing unless you can beat my challenges first.
Right, exactly.
You know, it's like, what it really feels like is the challenges are just a giant trap to lock you deep inside of the basement underneath the school.
Right.
You know, it's like, so as long as the traps don't hurt you along the way first, which many of them could, then you're just going to be deep inside of a cellar that you can't escape, nor can you do anything with.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I like your thought there, which would be that, like, yeah, on Snape is asking Filch for help because Dumbledore has asked Snape for help, and it all has to do with Quirrell. And the fact is that what Quirrell is ultimately going to find deep in the chamber is the Mirror of Erised, which is currently just in an unlocked classroom.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but is holding the stone.
Yeah, yeah. So that was going to be one of my questions for the thing, is whether or not you think the stone is already in there.
I do think it is, because otherwise, like, I mean, otherwise, if it's not, then Hagrid got it from Gringotts on July 31st, and it's just been out in the open in Dumbledore's office.
Yeah, true. Effectively, yeah, until Christmas. So for how many months is that? Yeah, quite a while.
Yeah, for 5 months or something. Yeah, yeah, that doesn't sound right. So no. I think it is already in there, like, even now.
Yeah. this is the tiniest little note in a total aside, but I did notice I haven't normally caught these before. There's a tiny Jim Dale narration error.
Oh.
And sometimes it's the case that we're reading the American copies versus the British copy, and there's like little mini, like, you know, small differences, mm-hmm. and stuff. But he does refer to Snape when it says, let's see here, because his soft, greasy voice was getting nearer, and to his horror, it was Snape. In the Jim Dale audiobook, he says Snipe.
Snipe.
Snipe. I listened to it three times just to be sure. I was like, am I hearing it wrong? It's like, no, he in fact says Snipe. Mm. So just a little Easter egg there. But either which way, so the arrival of both Snape and Filch basically forces Harry to pretty much, you know, exit the premises as quickly as he can. And interestingly, it is actually running from a situation that sort of leads him into the room, the unused classroom, where the Mirror of Erised is currently being held.
Yes. Which just sort of seems lucky. Like, I don't know how Dumbledore thought Harry was just going to stumble upon the mirror. But
you know, I mean, that's true. And it's like, this is like one of those things where it seems like, you know, just Dumbledore's intuition on some level. That was actually going to be my first thought when it came to Harry going to the restricted section. I like our magic most evil idea better, but my thought was almost like, if Dumbledore's just literally following Harry, like, from afar throughout the night, like, if he's like, you're not in the right place and I need to guide you somewhere else, if Dumbledore almost like caused the screaming
book, interesting. You know,
and Dumbledore sort of like, nope, you're not in the right spot, keep moving. Yeah, we'll get you there eventually. So that was my first thought, but I much prefer the magic most evil.
I like the
fact that would just be like a dark and terrifying loud screaming book. The magnificent mirror, as high as the ceiling, is an ornate gold frame standing on two clawed feet. I have always loved the Mirror of Erised.
Oh, it's one of my
favorite magical artifacts.
Very cool artifact.
If you've never discovered the not so hidden secret of it, the Erised, of course, stands for desire. And if you read the inscription carved around the top backwards or in the mirror, it says, "I show not your face, but your heart's desire."
Boom.
Which is kind of like one of those cool things that I like, just goes unexplained in the story. Like, it's sort of like a little little Easter egg for you to discover on your own.
And I love that you could solve it by looking at it in a mirror.
In a mirror. It's very clever. It's very clever. At this point in time, though, this is there's a couple of interesting little bits. One of them is that Harry is still wearing the invisibility cloak.
Yeah.
And the mirror is still able to reflect him.
Yes.
Which I think will pair nicely with our next piece of theory that we'd like to share with you guys today. So basically, our thought is, and this goes back to something that Dumbledore will eventually say to Harry inside of King's Cross Station after Harry has essentially intentionally faced death right at the end there. But Harry asks whether or not the Deathly Hallows are real. And inside of that sentiment, Dumbledore says, whether or not three brothers met death on a lonely road, I don't think so. But the three Peveril brothers were likely very gifted wizards and succeeded in creating those powerful objects.
Yes.
So what this means is that the Peveril brothers, once upon a time, dating back before the founding of Hogwarts, I believe.
It's very hard to say.
Yeah.
Whether the Peverils came first or the Founders came first, because we know at the very least at some point the Slytherin line intermingles with the second brother's line.
Right.
Because the Resurrection Stone becomes a Gaunt family heirloom.
You're correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they think it's the Peveril coat of arms, not the symbol of the Deathly Hallows. Okay, so that's a good point. But either way, what it means is that these men were once upon a time, possibly a full millennium ago, were quite the inventors and were able to create things that even within the confines or the lack of confines of magic are able to do things that standard magic cannot do.
Right.
And so they all sort of have, you know, possibly different underlying objectives. And one of our proposed theories rather is that the second brother basically sought to create the Resurrection Stone. So if you take away the idea that death plucked a river stone and turned it into the ability to bring back your lost love.
Right. That's what he's really trying to do, is bring back his lost fiance.
Yes, exactly. So we know that the second brother's true objective is effectively to do that. And so what we have proposed before is that prior to the creation of the Resurrection Stone, the second brother encountered a boggart. And what the boggart typically is capable of doing is creating your worst fear in physical form. And the basis of the thought here is that if the second brother was like, well, what if we were able to inverse the ability of the boggart and get it to show you your heart's truest desire. So maybe what you might say is that it reflects the ability boggart.
Right.
And essentially what he would have created or taken a boggart and done is transfigured it into the mirror of Erised.
Yeah, or like trapped it in a mirror in the way that Dumbledore puts the stone in the mirror or something.
Precisely. Yep, exactly. And pretty much the thought is that we know that the Resurrection Stone ultimately is the downfall of the second brother, and what it does is not bring him what he truly desires, but like sort of like a very light version of his lost love. As if seen through a veil.
Yeah. So it's interesting to me, and it feels like, because there's a line in here when Harry is seeing Lily, it says he noticed that she was crying. So like that to me is very interesting, because it sounds like it really is like Lily standing there. It's not like, because when he sees her, he doesn't even know who it is.
Right.
You know, and yet she's already crying.
Right.
So it's like it seems like it's truly Lily and James like staring at him from beyond.
From beyond.
Like
yes.
It's not just Harry's desire. It's like, I mean, it is his desire, but it's not just like reflecting what he wants. Because again, he doesn't even know what they look like.
Right.
And it's like, and it is showing exactly them. They show up anyway without him knowing what they look like. So there's that. And then the fact that she is able to have like an emotional reaction to cry is that like that this is it's like it's them.
This is the informed Lily who knows that this boy has lived without her.
Exactly. So there's that, and then it's like, but then like Harry is able to call them back with the Resurrection Stone as well,
right?
In like the same way. So like it does seem like it's sort of the same magic at play both cases.
And in both cases, I mean, even Dumbledore's own description of the dangers of the Mirror of Erised is that men have wasted away before it,
right?
And I think you could make the argument that the second brother wasted away on like upon his usage of the resurrection stone.
Right.
So anyway, that's I think it fits so beautifully, so perfectly. And even the fact that, you know, this is a question for you. I mean, we know that at one point in time, Dumbledore sought the Deathly Hallows. Kind of seems like the Mirror of Erised was in his possession.
Oh, it seems like, yeah, he's the one who has it. Like, yeah, I mean, we know it was there when, at least during the time of Fantastic Beasts as well.
Yes, yes. And so he's had it since at least the 1930s?
Yeah, so at least since then. It's like whether it belongs to the castle or Dumbledore is kind of up for debate.
Right.
But he certainly knows about it and used it then.
Right, right. Yeah. Yep, absolutely. So anyway, my headcanon in this particular case is that the Mirror of Erised was created by the second brother.
By the second brother.
Yep.
Yeah, although, man, as I'm thinking about it, there's like not... like the... The second brother, we know, brings back his fiance with the resurrection stone.
Right.
And like because he can't be with her, he ends up like killing himself.
Yeah.
Right. But we also know that Voldemort is a descendant of the second brother, right?
So how does he have a descendant?
So how does he have any descendants, right? Like, because for that to be true, it basically means, because like it means he must have either had Cadmus is the second brother.
Yes, Cadmus.
So, and it seems like Cadmus had one great love. So it just sounds like they must have had a child together before they got married. But then where is the child? Yeah, does he just abandon the child?
It's hard to know.
Yeah.
Because I mean the primary premise of the story that we hear includes the idea of death himself,
yeah,
granting these three gifts to the three brothers, and I tend to believe Dumbledore's version of it more, when it really comes down to it. So I think that they were talented wizards. So I mean, on some level, the idea of even if Cadmus were to have had a child with someone else, it almost even feels like it would fit in the same way that Tom Riddle was the product of, you know, Merope Gaunt and Tom Riddle Sr., mm-hmm. where it's like an otherwise sort of unrequited love.
Yeah.
You know, like he's the product of, if Cadmus's child that was the start of that lineage sort of also shared that commonality with Tom Riddle himself, Voldemort himself.
Yeah.
Like the product of... what am I trying to say here? Not being the product of love. It feels like that would be possibly something that would fit. But
whoever the child is, they must end up with the ring too. Like he must have, you know, because he must end up with the stone.
Sure.
Because it stays in the family.
This is a good point.
Right? So there's like a missing Peveril child along the way.
Well,
here.
as per ever, I mean, you know, this goes back to our deepest desire, you know, if like we talked about, you know, there being a long form Harry Potter series, but what we would truly love above all else is like a founder series. And I could completely see a world. I would be okay with adjusting the canon to reflect a world where the Peverils and the founders exist in the same sequence of events in some capacity, or else if the Peverils are relevant to that narrative in some way, shape, or form.
It does seem like that would have to be the case in some way, shape, or form as well.
Yeah.
Or like, yeah, that they could at least like meet them or something, because they would otherwise be three great, powerful wizards of the day.
That's the thing. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, even a world where you could have opposing ideals, where the founders themselves are more in the spirit of we need to share our magical knowledge. And I could see a world where the Peverils are highly talented wizards who did the opposite. And
right.
they thought we don't share.
Right.
What we know,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's part of what makes those artifacts in particular, because nobody else has ever made anything else like them.
I know. Yeah.
So they stand alone in their unique abilities.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be interesting to see if they like all interacted with each other, because you could definitely see like Salazar interacting with Cadmus or something in some way. As like a little like, oh, well, their offspring are going to get together someday or something.
Yeah. Yeah. There they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this
true.
Is the other thing that people don't think about is that Salazar Slytherin, they're like, oh,
has a child.
He has a child.
Yeah.
Like there is a great lost love somewhere with Salazar Slytherin
yes.
as well. And it's yes. like that part, like, there's something there that we don't know about.
We could tangent so hard and just go into all of our thoughts and feelings on like what the founder's life was like and how Slytherin attained his you know what is otherwise infamous perspective on you know relations between the wizarding and non-wizarding populations and stuff. I mean,
such thoughts I have.
Right. No, I know. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, in the meantime,
Harry seeing his family for the first time.
I was gonna say we literally tangented right before like the most impactful portion of the whole chapter.
But it's a very sad part.
It is very sad. Maybe we were delaying the inevitable, which is just this idea of such a young child who has basically had to live, you know, essentially like a solitary existence, doesn't know what his own family looks like, and is now being granted the ability to look into the faces of his two parents.
Hate the Dursleys. Like, I get that boy. I don't know. I mean, they're obviously terrible to him, but I'm just circling back to it in my mind. Like, it has not occurred to me before that Petunia never showed Harry a picture of her, at least Lily.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it makes me so mad.
I know. I think it's just a deleted movie scene only, which breaks my heart that they deleted it. But there is one scene, I believe, from Deathly Hallows Part One, where the Dursleys are leaving, and there's an exchange with Petunia where she basically says, like, you're not the only one who lost someone that day. And it's always been one of those things that I think humanizes Petunia in a way that's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's sort of like maybe part of like this great big defense that she has, the reason that she has such hostility towards magic, like at this point isn't even her jealousy from childhood, but it's more the mourning sensation she's experiencing attached to the loss of her sister, who she once loved so dearly.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like it just sucks all the way around. So I much prefer a world where Petunia has like more of like a deep struggle. Not that it's defensible in any capacity, nor that Harry should ever have been subjected to the life that he was subjected to. But anyway, that's my thoughts on that. But yeah, so Harry gets this experience of being able to look into the faces of his two parents. She was a very pretty woman. She had dark red hair and her eyes are just like mine, Harry thought, edging a little closer to the glass. Bright green, exactly the same shape. But then he noticed that she was crying, smiling but crying at the same time. The tall, thin, black-haired man standing next to her put his arm around her. He wore glasses, and his hair was very untidy. This is just like, it's a very cool moment. It's amazing to see Harry seeing himself and his two parents. I love the way in which Harry embodies both parents and his physical attributes. One of the details that I've only just recently stumbled across that I've been curious to hear your thoughts on is whether or not James's Patronus and Animagus form as a stag is at all supposed to reflect his extremely untidy hair.
His hair sticks up like antlers.
Like antlers. Yeah. Is that like supposed to be a thing? Or
I don't know. It could be there. It always looks like, I never imagine Harry's like hair sticking up like antler style. I always imagine there being like a cowlick in the back that like won't go down or something.
Yeah, it's always messier than I feel like the movies ever depicted. You know, like,
yeah,
like
that's
especially
true.
In the first movie, he's almost got more of like just like a long bowl cut. It's not exactly like unruly.
Right. Anyway. Yeah.
But yeah, so it's that just such a good moment. And then of course, yeah, Mom, he whispered, Dad. Just break you right in half.
It's so sad.
Just a moment of silence.
So much worse as a parent, too.
I know.
Oh, my gosh. I know.
Can't imagine your kid having that experience. So anyway, we can work ourselves through this. We can surely do it.
So it's in the movie, he only sees his parents, and in the book, he actually sees like his entire extended family back there,
yep,
which is kind of cool. Anyway, well, then he runs back to Ron.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's the next morning.
Yeah.
So he says, you could have woken me up, said Ron crossly. You can come tonight. I'm going back. I want to show you the mirror. I love the fact that Ron immediately says, I'd love to see your mom and dad. And
I know. What a good friend.
I know. But then Harry matches and he says, and I want to see all your family, all the Weasleys. You'll be able to show me your other brothers and everyone. And Ron's like, you can see them any old time.
Yeah, whatever. They're not very special.
Right.
Which kind of plays into it, like Ron. It's like he says that like as if like, oh yeah, whatever. They're just there. But then like Ron's deepest ambition, like a page later, is to be just like all of them.
Well, it's to be just like all of them. But there's a couple of like, there is also also the additional layer for Ron in that, like, he is constantly having to try to find a way to stand out amongst the siblings because he is just standing alone.
Right.
When Ron looks in the mirror. And the kind of interesting thing about Ron and what he's seeing in the mirror is it says, no, I'm alone, but I'm different. I look older and I'm head boy. I'm wearing the badge like Bill used to, and I'm holding the house cup, the Quidditch cup. I'm Quidditch captain too. What's kind of fascinating about this is that, like, it is almost all of this in some capacity sort of comes to fruition. Maybe not quite to the extent that Ron's envisioning it here. But on the one hand, Ron in his fifth year does become a prefect.
Yep.
He is on the Quidditch team. Mm-hmm. He is the hero. You know, there's the whole Weasley is our king. He's the one who's able to bring home the Quidditch cup.
Yep.
But even the alone thing is oddly reflected in that part of him being the hero of the team comes in the wake of Fred, George, and Harry all being kicked off the
team. Yeah.
So, like, Ron seeing himself alone, it does almost like foreshadow, like, and then eventually alone, Ron is the one
right
to, you know, like, achieve.
Well, Ginny's still on the team. But I guess he's not being compared. I guess even in this sense, he's not comparing himself to her. It's like to all of his older brothers.
That's true.
So yeah, there's that. Shadow. Yeah. I mean, it's like, yeah, he does always want to stand out. And then he ultimately, like, you know, does defeat, you know, one of the Horcruxes and all that. So, yeah, he stands out pretty good.
Yeah, Ron does a good job.
Yeah, good job. Good job. Yeah.
Way to go, Ron. Way to go, Ron.
solid work.
Yes, yes. It is kind of interesting, and I'd be curious. I mean, it doesn't take very long before we get the full explanation, but I'd be curious if people would be able to, you know, start to piece together what exactly is going on, like why they're seeing different things or you know, like what the underlying function mm-hmm. of the mirror is, which I think sort of like tees us up for Harry going back on his third night, which I guess at this point in time is December 27th.
Yep.
Because we would have gone on Christmas.
The next night with Ron and the 27th. Yep.
Yep. At this point in time, Harry finds his way back to the room once again. He's looking into the faces of his mother and father when he hears somebody in the room with him. So back again, Harry.
Yes. Back again means that he knows about the other two times.
Yes. Yes, he does. Yep. So the big question to me is sort of whether or not, yeah, like is Dumbledore just in the room on each occasion?
He almost has to be because, he at the very least has to be there on the second night because he knows what Ron saw in the mirror too.
Yes, there's that.
And it's like, it seems unusual to me that he wouldn't have been there the first night. And the way he says, so back again, like it doesn't sound like, I mean, I guess you could just mean like, oh, you were here last night and tonight. That could be again. But like, it almost like implies like, oh, again.
Right.
Like it's like, I think he's been there every single night.
Yes. Yeah.
Seeing what Harry is seeing.
Yes.
So strange how nearsighted being invisible can make you. It's like he knows Harry's been out in the invisibility cloak because, of course, he knows he's the one who gave it to him.
Yes, of course.
Which Harry doesn't know. And he's like smiling at Harry. So it's like, you've done beautifully, Harry. Like, you know, not only did you get the cloak, you put it on, you found the mirror, and what you saw in the mirror, my God, I'm just beaming over here. Like, this is great.
Could not be more proud.
Could not be more proud.
Then, of course, you know, we get the explanation, you know, basically the happiest man on earth would be able to use the mirror of Erised like a normal mirror. That is, he would look into it and see himself exactly as he is, which I put just an ounce of emphasis on because I feel like when Dumbledore himself is asked the question, what would you see when you look in the mirror? Dumbledore basically says, I see myself holding a pair of thick woolen socks. This is sort of like a, you could interpret it a couple of different ways. The socks modifier is certainly a rather small one in the scheme of things.
Yeah.
You know, it would basically mean that like Dumbledore's most like he basically sees himself exactly as he is with a pair of socks.
Right.
You know, it's like, that's what I really need because people only give me books, but I still need.
It's like, it's not that hard to get socks. So, you know,
yeah.
It feels like you could do that.
Dumbledore on a headmaster Sally, it's attainable.
What's interesting is that we eventually learn what Dumbledore would see in the mirror. And it is just his family together and whole, which is awesome. But when you think about it, it's basically the same thing Harry sees.
Yes. You know,
a little bit, which also pretty much tracks with, like, if you get more into like Dumbledore's history, like with the Secrets of Dumbledore, at the end of it, like the Chilling, like kneels to him and declares him as pure of heart or whatever.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, that's sort of almost like more proof of it. Like Dumbledore is basically so proud of Harry because Harry sees, he's like, do you know how few people could see what you saw in the mirror? But it's like Dumbledore also basically sees what Harry sees in the mirror.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So like, I think that this is probably verification for Dumbledore at this point in time. Like this boy is like a piece of me, like, you know, he's already
very pure.
He's very pure.
But like, and like Dumbledore wouldn't have seen that until later in life, like much later in life.
Correct.
As well, because we know that as a much younger Dumbledore, not even a much younger, like 40, 50 years prior, Dumbledore is seeing Grindelwald in the mirror.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. So like Harry arrives there. He's like basically born and is as pure as Dumbledore eventually gets to much later in life.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. Yep.
So, I mean, he even says that to Harry. He's like, I've known for a long time now that you're a much better man than me or whatever. And it's like, yeah, it's like, I've known since the moment you saw that mirror. I was like, whoa, okay, this kid.
Yes. 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 Yeah. Yes. And that being said, we then get the line. And this is the last little major wink from Dumbledore's big plan kind of concept. The mirror will be moved to a new home tomorrow, Harry. And I ask you not go looking for it again. And if you ever do run across it, you will now be prepared.
If you do run across it, and I know where it'll be, hidden in a secret chamber under the school where no one should ever run across it ever. But if you do see it.
Yeah, now you know what's going on. Yeah. Yeah.
And like, what do you mean you know what? You'll be prepared. Prepared for what? To see his parents again? Like, right. What does he need to be prepared for?
Right. But it all seems to like fit together to me. It's like basically like, okay, it's the winter holidays. It's a great time to present Harry with a gift, especially anonymously, because it's sort of like, you know, like it's a time where it's not just like, oh, like the broomstick, you know, like it's like, this is a time when people receive gifts. So we can like innocuously present the gift.
Right.
It's also when most of the students are not inside of the school.
Right.
The gift itself presents the ability to then wander about the school. So it's like the mirror being where it is when it is during this particular time, all of Dumbledore's like, you know, meddling all but suggests to me that he's basically like, okay, here's the moment, like, mm-hmm. we are inside of the stage of the plan where there's nobody, we don't have to worry about anybody stumbling in on us. He will absolutely, you know, as long as he's his father's son, he will go exploring in the middle of the night, you know. My hope is that he will just stumble across the mirror, because he just needs, like, the one thing that I, you know, that I can't count on Ron or Hermione or his other teachers to impart upon him, you know, is how and what the mirror actually is. So this is the occasion.
Right.
Let's do it. And in the process, Dumbledore is also testing Harry's worthiness.
Yeah, that he is. And that pretty much brings us to the end of the chapter. I don't have a ton more to say, but the final sentence is just, but then he thought, as he shoved Scabbers off his pillow, it had been quite a personal question. And I was just like, man, oh, good, look at you, Peter, sleeping on Harry's pillow.
How dare you?
What a jerk.
How dare you?
Harry, the gall on that rat.
I know. Especially because like what Harry is going to do on these occasions where he's not in his own bed is to see his parents. The parents who are not there because of Peter.
I know, exactly. And like, Scabbard, like, Peter knows. He's even watching him go under the cloak. They would have seen James doing it. Yeah. Like, Peter sucks.
Peter does suck.
Oh, my gosh.
He's like as bad as the Dursleys.
Oh, my gosh.
And Aunt Marge, who I also don't like at all.
Aunt Marge is basically like Umbridge Light.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned.
The thing that I sort of love, you know, sort of to close off the chapter, the thing that is fascinating to me is about the Mirror of Erised. Like, I always wonder, you know, and of course, the ever-personal question, like, what would you see inside of the mirror of Erised? Yeah. I think a lot of times for me, I always find it like, I feel like it would be rather informative. Like, I think in a lot of ways, there's a part of me that, like, you know, I know the things that I deeply value. I know the things that are important to me. But like, I almost feel like if I were to look into the mirror of Erised and have something proven back to me, it's like, Ben, the thing you value the most is this.
Right.
And it's like, I think it would like sort of like solidify, because like, I think I'm able to underestimate every important thing in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. Or I'll let myself believe, like, oh, it's cliche for that to be, like, you know, for this to be the most important thing to me, like, that's you're following the storybook logic, you know, or
right,
something
yeah.
like that, you know? But what is truly right, most like, important like to
achieving
you?
World peace or something, Ben, should be, like, the most important thing to you, like, yeah.
Sure, yeah. Like, you know, I mean, that's
don't
like,
be so basic.
What do you see in the mirror? I see myself achieving world peace, of course, as should everybody.
Right, it's like, yeah. the correct answer.
Right, yeah. Right, yeah. It's like, no, you see yourself just like sitting on a beach and, you know, some type of really cool place, and maybe there's like some treasure to be found and like a boat kind of stationed just offshore. It's like it would be so interesting for me to look in the mirror and be like, that had been literally, I'm telling you right now, that is what you want the most.
Do you think you'd be surprised by what you saw?
I think I would be surprised by what I saw.
Yeah.
I do genuinely. And I also feel like I would pursue it.
I feel like it could, because like, yeah, I think you're right. I think people are good at lying to themselves.
I think so. Yeah. I think it's hard to know. Like you can, like anything else, like what's your Patronus? What's your Boggart? You know, like they're all like highly informative questions. What house are you in? They're all questions that sort of like show some piece of your character or what you value the most. But like, it's a complicated question to answer.
Yeah, it is.
So for me to be presented with the answer to that question, like that's like the, like, that maybe that's what I would see, is me knowing the answer.
Right. Like, yeah.
Maybe above all else, what I would love is to just know what I would see.
Maybe.
So anyway, maybe what that means is that I would see a version of myself looking into the mirror, and that version of me inside of the mirror would be like jumping for joy because that version of me knows what I saw.
Oh, very meta.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The meta mirror.
The meta mirror. Classic.
Right.
Anyway, as ever, we need to review the chapter art, which I feel like we never review very aggressively, but
it's basically just Harry looking into the mirror.
It is Harry looking into the mirror. I think that you and I have mirrors in our homes that are kind of like nice gold or no, not real gold.
Not real, yeah.
We bought the same
Calm
one.
Calm down.
Yeah, but they're mirror of Erised-esque mirrors.
They are, yeah.
I will say in this particular instance, I actually like the movie prop version of the mirror more than the presented illustration.
Although, oh, yeah.
I do like how grand and tall it is in the chapter art.
Yeah.
But I see it more as a, it's a rectangle mirror in the chapter art. And I see it more as like a, I don't know, like it comes to like a point.
Like an arched. In the chapter art almost makes it look like it like was an animal or something. Like it's got like its clawed feet are like were feet, and like it's the stand on the back was like a tail or something.
You're right. Yeah. It almost seems to look like it could have been like a lion or something.
Yeah. It does. Lion is exactly what I was thinking too. Maybe because the mirror is sort of in the shape of like a mane, or like the frame kind of looks like a mane.
Yep.
And then it's as if like, which is, it's kind of funny because Harry is in a Gryffindor looking, and it's like, what is the reflected lion in you or something, you know?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. Sure. Yep. Even at the top, if you look carefully, it almost seems like a pair of eyes. Kind of right up top there.
It does. You're right. Circles. It kind of looks like little circles.
Actually,
there.
You know, if you really look at it, it kind of looks like Baby Grogu from Star Wars.
Oh my gosh. You're right. I definitely see it.
Yeah, that's kind of amazing.
1,000%. Yeah, oh, that's amazing.
Man. That's so funny. Anyway. Okay.
So great chapter art. Well there done, we Harry. I love how giant the mirror looks in comparison. I guess it's like 12 feet tall or something, right? It's huge.
I believe so. Yeah. Yeah. It seems like very tall. Very massive tall. But mirror. We also know, considering the height of the troll, that even just the bathrooms in Hogwarts have pretty high ceilings.
Yeah.
So,
it's a big old place. Lots big old place.
Lots of room for vertical furniture.
Let's see. And then as ever, we have a review from one of our amazing listeners. I didn't copy the name. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, no.
It just says, amazing. So good. I'm from Sweden, but live in England, and peppermint humbugs are a British sweet or candy. I listen to the podcast every day. Please, can you do more than one episode a week? All my friends and family listen to this podcast, so thank you for inventing it.
Oh, that's so amazing.
Man, I don't think we'll do more than one a week. Thank you for the suggestion. But we want to, you know, give ourselves a lot of runway here. However, we have discussed doing like, after we've like finished a book, putting together like a giant like supercut, so you could listen to us review all 17 chapters at once.
Yeah, like one.
Yeah, one like after the other.
One big long 17-hour.
17-hour cut.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, like, what I like about this, though, is that you could go to bed at night, start listening to chapter one, wake up the next morning, and not be done.
That would be something. That'd be the longest video we'd ever uploaded anywhere. This is the longest episode of this podcast. So there you go. We've done basically one and a half for you on today anyway.
There you go. That's exactly right. That's exactly it. So as ever, guys, thank you so much for tuning into this week's chapter. Like I said from the very beginning, this is one of my favorite chapters in the entire story, in fact. So I'm glad that we were able to provide as much commentary as we were. But otherwise, until next time,
we will see you through the Gryffindor.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.